Parshas Vayechi. Our parsha is called Vayechi Yaakov, and Yaakov lived, and he did live. These last 17 years of his life were the only years of his adult life that he lived in peace, and that he lived with satisfaction, and he lived a life of fulfillment with his children all around him, successful, with menucha, and he's grateful. He's very grateful for these years. And yet, this parsha that is called Vayechi Yaakov is the parsha of Yaakov's death, as Chaye Sarah is the parsha of Sarah's death. When we think about Yaakov's death, we realize that Yaakov's death was a turning point for the Jewish nation. In fact, Rashi tells us that this is a parsha stuma, which means in the Torah there's no indentation between the end of Vayigash, the last pasuk in Vayigash, and this first pasuk of Vayechi. There's no indication that we're starting a whole new story. It just continues. There's no indentation, and so it's called a parsha stuma. And Rashi explains that this parsha is stuma because Rashi says it's our very first Rashi, Lama Parsha Zestuma. Why is this Parsha closed up in a sense? Why is it budding up right next to the Parsha before it without any break? Lefi Shekevan Sheniftar Yaakov Avinu, because when Yaakov died, Nistamu Einehem Belibam Shel Yisrael Mitzaras Hashibud, the eyes and the hearts of the Jewish people were also kind of closed up or became beclouded. Darkened because of the tzara of the servitude which began at that point. Now, the truth is, later on Rashi tells us in Shemos that they really were never enslaved until the last of the Shvatim died, and the last of the Shvatim to die was Levi. He outlived his brothers. And at that point, the Shibud, the servitude, started. So, firstly, the fact that Rashi indicates here that as soon as he died, things began to get bad and their hearts and their eyes were closed up, needs some type of an explanation. My grandfather, Rav Shuav, points out that you notice a strange change takes place when Yaakov dies. The psukim tell us that after he finished giving his brachas and he himself dies, which we will speak about, Yosef goes to try to fulfill the promise he made to bury him in Eretz Yisrael. And the pasuk tells us the following: Vayavru yimei b'chiso, and the days of the mourning of him passed, which were 70 days. If you look in the psukim before this, it tells us that the physicians embalmed him. He had a 40-day term of embalming. This is in Perek Nun 50. Pasuk Dalid, we're focusing on, but the previous Pesukim tell us that he had a 40-day period of embalming him, and then there was a 30-day period of mourning him, and then after that, in Pasuk Dalid, V'yadaber Yosef el beis Paro lemar, Yosef approaches the palace of Paro, the household of Paro, saying, Imnama tasichein beinechem, if I have found favor in your eyes, Dabruna, please speak to Paro on my behalf, and tell him that I've sworn to my father to bury him in Canaan. Notice, Yosef, Mishneh LeMelech, he runs the whole country. Nobody raises a hand or a foot, the pasuk tells us, without Yosef's permission, is already not quite what he used to be. He has no access to Paro. He has to go to the palace and ask the guards there to do him a favor and speak to Paro, and request from Paro to allow him to fulfill his promise. So my grandfather Schwab points out here, that's already an indication that as soon as Yaakov died, things began to change, though they didn't feel it. He was still a rich man and a powerful man, a very respected man, but things were changing. Things were changing already, and their status was diminishing, which really seems to tell us that he was only elevated to this position. Really, in the end, the Egyptians benefited, no question about it. But he was raised to this position because of his family and what he was meant to do for his family, to take care of his family, to sustain and protect his family, to set them up in Mitzrayim with kavod. That's why he was raised up to this level. And as soon as Yaakov dies and it's time for the Shibud to begin, Hashem starts diminishing also Yosef's position. Notice also the last pasuk in Vayigash gives us an indication that imperceptibly the Gullus had begun. While they were down there, things were beginning to take root, though they did not really recognize it yet. Not until the last of the Shvatim died, that's Levi, did they feel it. But the last pasuk in Vayigash says, Vayeshev Yisrael be'eretz Mitzrayim be'eretz Goshen. They all lived in Goshen. And look at the next word. Vayeachazu ba vayifru vayirbu ma'od. And they took hold of it and they multiplied and were fruitful. But vayeachazu is not, doesn't really mean and they took hold of the land. They were taken hold of by the land. The land exerted a hold on them, so that even if they wanted to leave, they really could not leave until the designated time would come, which would be way into the future. Okay? The word, this is a form of nifal. It happened to them. They were held by the land. So you begin to see, though they don't notice it yet, their lives haven't gotten harder, things are beginning to change. And so Yaakov's death now really is a very significant moment because it begins the darkness, the gullus. And yet at the same time, when Yaakov dies and the darkness really begins to descend on the Jewish people, we begin to see where we enter into a long, dark tunnel that we don't see the end in front of us. Rashi goes and points out that although Yaakov dies and things get worse, implicit in the way the pasuk describes his death is the idea that he really didn't die, that he still lived. Now look at Rashi. Look in page 284. That's Perek Memtes 49, pasuk 36. And the pasuk reads, Vayechal Yaakov Letzavos Espanov, he completed instructing his children, Vayesof Raglov, he drew his feet onto the bed, Elamita, Vayigva, he expired, Vaye Osef El Amo, and was gathered to his people. So Rashi says here, Vayigva, Vaye Osef, Umisa lo nemrabo, but it doesn't say vayomas, that he died. Vayigva, that he expired. It doesn't use the word vayomas. Va'amru razal, our tradition teaches us, our rabbanim teach us, Yaakov Avinu lo meis. Yaakov Avinu did not die. Now we have a Rashi here, quoted from a Gemara in Tanis. Yaakov never died. What do we do with that? How do we understand that? On the one hand, this is the beginning of the darkness, the beginning of the gullus. And at the same time, the one that initiates it is alive. Something is still alive within this, despite this, the essence of Yaakov. What do we mean when we say he didn't die? So anybody reading Pshat can ask many questions on this statement in the Gemara that he didn't die. Simple Pshat. The pasuk says they buried him. The pasuk says they embalmed him. How do you do that when someone's not dead? The pasuk says they buried him in Ma'aras HaMachpelah. Of course he died. It's clear that he died. What does the Gemara mean when it says he didn't die? So here, quoting from the Gemara in Tanis, it says like this. Yaakov Avinu lo meis, Yaakov didn't die. So Rabbi Yitzchak, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, says he didn't die, and Rav Nachman asks him, what do you mean he didn't die? Don't we know they embalmed him? We know they buried him. So he answers the following. Amarlo, he answers, Mikra ani doresh. I am learning the drush of this pasuk. I am doresh the pasuk. I know the pshat says he died, but I am now learning the drush. Shenemar, and he quotes a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, and the pasuk says, and this is about the eventual geula that will take place, Yirmiyahu says, Va'ata altira avdi Yaakov. Now, you, do not be afraid, my servant Yaakov. Ne'um Hashem, these are the words of God. Va'al techas, and do not become disheartened, Yisrael. Ki hinani moshiacha me'rachok, I will help you and save you from afar. Ve'zaracha me'eretz shivyam, and your seed from the land of their captivity. V'shav Yaakov, and Yaakov will return home. V'shakat, and he will rest. V'sha'anan, and he will dwell at ease. V'ein machrid, and no one will disturb him. This is a nevuah that Yaakov, which represents, of course, always the nation in the deep, dark gullus, should not be afraid. And Yisrael, which represents the Jews emerging into the state of Geula, should not be disheartened that it takes long, or that things aren't going well, or that they've lost their institutions, their monarchy, their priests, because I will save you, and I will save your children from the lands of their captivity, and you'll return, and you will dwell in peace, and things will come back to the way they should be. So Rav Yitzchak says, I'm learning from here, I'm making a hekesh, which means I'm making a connection, and I'm learning from here, that this means that Mazaro b'chayim, as his children are alive, afhu b'chayim, so he is alive. Now, the question is, what is Rav Yitzchak saying? Rav Yitzchak saying that as his children do live, literally they do live, so he also is alive. Now, is this a clear answer to the question? The question is, how could you say Yaakov didn't die? The pasuk says he died. So the answer is, I'm darshaning a pasuk that as his children are destined to stay alive and to be returned, so he is alive. Does that mean he's alive physically, or he is alive spiritually? So now we begin to analyze this whole idea, which we hear all the time, about drush, pshat versus the drush. Let's think about this for a minute. We have heard the idea that shivim panim la Torah, there are 70 ways to interpret Torah, and the number 70 probably means an enormous and unlimited ways of understanding Torah. As there are 70 nations, and today the world is considered to have many, many more than 70 nations, the concept is, it seems, that the totality of humanity is called the 70 nations. Torah can be understood in every generation, in every situation, in every culture, in some way that is relevant to that situation, that culture. Shivim panim la Torah. But nevertheless, even though there's shivim panim la Torah, 70 facets to the Torah, Torah is always relevant somehow or some way. We can find the relevance in the words of the Torah. The truth of Torah breaks down into four categories, not 70. Four. You know what they are. Pardes, pshat, remez, drush, and sod. Now, when we talk about the four categories of the truth of Torah, what do we mean? What do we mean when we say this is pshat, this is drush, remez, and sod? We don't mean, as we use in the mundane world, that there is a pshat. The pshat is that I'm angry because I say that I am angry. That's pshat. But if I don't want to say I am angry, so I hint, remez. Well, it's, you know, I use body language, or I make a comment that's sarcastic in a very pleasant way. So I don't look angry, I'm not saying angry words, but it's clear that I'm hinting to the fact that I'm angry. That's a remez. But in the mundane, notice that either the pshat or the remez, either way we deliver the information that I'm angry, we're still delivering the same information that I'm angry, which means pshat is one delivery system. It's obvious, it's not up for misinterpretation. And remez is another delivery system, but they both are delivering the same information. This is not the case in learning Torah. In learning Torah, they are not delivering the same information. They are delivering four different realities that coexist in parallel universes all together at the same time. There is a world of pshat that we can see and feel and touch. But there's a world of drush and a world of remez and a world of sod, and they all exist. And that way of interpreting the Torah gives us access into that world that is concurrent with the other world, four parallel truths, realities. If you get into mysticism, which I do not know much about, I just know that they speak about four worlds, four olamos, You might have heard phrases like this. That creation exists in four different worlds. In any case, when we interpret Torah according to Pshat versus Drush, we're entering into two different worlds, both equally true, but not the same as each other at all. So Rav Huttner explains this idea in relationship to Yaakov Lomeis, and he brings an example. And this example clarifies the idea very carefully. He brings the example, quoting from the Maharal, that there is a phrase by the story of when Paro's daughter went down to the river that day to bathe and saw Moshe in the little teva that his mother made for him, and she attempted to save him. So the pasuk says, Bas Paro v'naro seha, the daughter of Paro and her handmaidens, holchos al yad hayar, are walking by the river. So the Chachamim say there, what does it mean they're walking by the river? Shahayu holchos lamisa, that they were walking to their death. Al shemichu ba shalotikach es hayeled, because they were trying to tell her not to save him. They were literally going to their death by trying to convince the daughter of Paro not to save Moshe from the river. Now, the pshat is they're walking by the river. Chachamim say they're walking towards their death. One is pshat, one is not pshat. The Torah doesn't say they were going to die, and they didn't die. They went back to the palace with her, and they probably served her for many years after that. But in pshat, they're walking on the river. Chachamim come and say they're going to die. They're walking to their death. Now, they bring an example that holchos is used in association with death. Holech b'derech kol ha'aretz, are going in the way of everybody who eventually dies. The Maharal says here that the death that the Chachamim are speaking about, that they're walking towards, that they're going, they're becoming closer to, is a death called a Misa Elyona, a death in the higher spheres. Not a death here, but a death in the higher spheres. Now, what is death in the higher spheres? So Maharal explains that they lost their ability to have any influence on her. In other words, what they did was inconsequential. What they said didn't matter. They had no power to coerce her. They had no power to change her mind. In other words, they were insignificant now, in spirit. They were just humans with a body, you know, walking, going through the motions, but they had no sphere of influence in this world. That's a form of death in a spiritual sense. Their physical bodies are very much alive, but they have absolutely, they have no consequence anymore. Nothing they say matters. So Maharal explains, Nistalak me'am kocham umazalam legamre, they had no more power at all. This is called Misa Elyona, death in the higher spheres. When the Chachamim say that they're going to their death, they're saying in the world of Pshat, they're walking by the river. That's true information that exists. In the world beyond Pshat, in the world of Drush, which is another world, it's not another way of saying the same thing. It's a whole different reality that is currently operative, exists at this moment. They have lost their sphere of influence because they tried to tell her, Bas Paro, not to save Moshe. She, therefore, their influence was nullified. She didn't listen to them. They were irrelevant, and she saved Moshe. They were dead. That was also true. That happened. It didn't happen in a way that the human eye could see it. It didn't happen in a way that we could touch it or feel it. It happened in the world of Drush. So we're talking about parallel worlds. When we speak about Paradise, that there's also a world of Remez, you know, Gematrias, the real Gematrias of the Rishonim, the authentic Gematrias, not the funny little ones everyone makes up, they come from a world of Remez, of hint. Tells you that the gematria of one word is equal to the gematria of the other word. Therefore, the two words are related in theory, and they share power together. This is from a world of remes, and then there's sod. Sod is beyond almost everybody. Sod is the deep secrets that preceded the world. Pardes. Now, interestingly enough, we have a tefillah every day in Shacharis. later on also in Maariv, we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to give us insight when we learn Torah on all four levels. We should have some access to understanding the Torah on each of these levels. All of the Shivim Panim LaTorah, the 70 facets, fall into one of these four. Usually, much of what we learn is Pshat, different ways of understanding the Pshat itself, Drush, then the deeper and deeper we don't always have an understanding to or access to. Nevertheless, every morning we make the bracha that begins with Ahava Rabba right before Shema. And it's a bracha for knowledge of Torah. And if you notice, my grandfather points out in his Tefillah Sefer, we list our requests for depth of understanding in Torah in groups of four. So here's how it goes. Avinu of Harachaman, Hamarachem, Rachem Aleinu. Four levels of compassion. Our Father, our compassionate Father that has Rachmanas on us, have deeper Rachmanas on us. Notice that. Then we say, V'sein Bilibeinu, put into our hearts, Lahavin, Lahaskil, Lishmoa, Lilmod. Four levels to learning. Okay, in English you might call them... Lahavin is to understand, Lahaskil to elucidate, Lishmoa to listen, and Lilmo to learn. By the way, it goes from the deepest to the from the deepest levels of Pardes to the most simpler levels, the most obvious levels. And then we say, Lilamed, Lishmar, Lasos, Ulakayim. Four ways of expressing what we've learned: to teach it, to guard it, to do it, and to uphold it. Four ways of expressing that. As called Divrei Talmud Torah Secha B'Ava, V'ha'arei neinu b'sorasecha, enlighten our eyes with your Torah, Tabek libeinu b'mitzvosecha, let our hearts cling to your mitzvos, V'yachay levaveinu, and combine our two impulses, la'ahava u'liyira, to love you and to fear you. So each day, in the bracha before Shema, which is the bracha for knowledge of Torah, we're asking HaKadosh Baruch Hu to grant us access to the levels, the worlds of reality that exist, that the Torah is teaching us, if we knew how to learn and we understood the hints and the secrets in the Torah, from the deepest, and if we're not worthy of the deepest, to the next highest, to the highest, at least to the basic understanding of Torah. Some people mangle even the basic pshat of Torah by introducing assumptions that they have no right to assume, information that isn't written, that they impose onto the text, modern day psychological issues that they assume were, also relevant then, which were not. It's not even learning pshat. But we ask for truth and insight into the four levels of Torah. And each one is a world on its own and exists completely on its own. Now, this is a case in our situation here with Yaakov Avinu Lomes. So the pshat is he died clearly. But Rabbi Yitzchak is saying, I'm learning the drush. And in the drush, he didn't die, because as his children live and will live into the future, and God will return them and they will continue to exist, so he will continue to exist. Let's take that further. What do we mean by that? That his sphere of influence continues to exist like the daughters of Paro? Is that what it means? What do we mean when we say, as the children, the Klal Yisrael, Pshat, we are here alive. This is in the world of Pshat, we live. So in the world of Drush, Yaakov is alive. That what? That he is, that his memory remains with us? Let's take this further. His existence is that, and the question is, isn't everybody who aren't all our ancestors alive with us, Avraham and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, aren't they all with us and alive? Why is Yaakov specified here? So here we go into another idea Rav Huttner explains. What's unique about Yaakov's life? Yaakov, we said, he died in the Pshat, but he did not die in the Drush. There is another character in Tanakh that doesn't die in the Pshat. In Pshat, he doesn't die, and that is Eliyahu HaNavi from Malachim Beis, where the Torah tells us he's walking with Elisha, and a fiery chariot and comes with horses and gathers him up and takes him in a storm up to Shemayim. That's Pshat. So there's a connection between Yaakov, who doesn't die in the world of Drush, but dies in the world of Pshat, and Eliyahu Hanavi, who doesn't die in the world of Pshat. Now there's a very unusual connection between them. In Chumash, in Vayikra, turn to page 716, Perek Chavav, Pasuk Mem Beis, talking about the end of days. Vizacharti es brisi Yaakov. Look how Yaakov is written. I will remember the bris I made with Yaakov. V'yaf es brisi Yitzchak, and even the covenant I made with Yitzchak. V'yaf es brisi Avraham, and the covenant I made with Avram. Eskar v'ha'aretz eskar, speaking about the future, that in the end Hashem will remember the promises He made to them. Yaakov is written Moleh. This is the only time in Chumash that his name is written Moleh. And there are four places in Yirmiyahu that his name is written Moleh, each of them referring to the Geula, which we'll come to in a moment. Look in the Rashi here. B'chamisha makomot nechtav Moleh. In five places in the Tanakh, Yaakov's name is written with a vav. Be'eliyahu chaser b'chamisha makomos. And the name Eliyahu is written without a vav in five places. Yaakov natal os mishmo shel Eliyahu. Yaakov took a letter from the name of Eliyahu, Eravon, as a guarantee. Sheyavo v'yavaser geula banav, that Eliyahu will come and he will announce the geula of his children. The vav of Yaakov here written Mole is taken from Eliyahu. Eliyahu and Yaakov have a connection. Eliyahu will come and announce that Hashem is returning Klal Yisrael, that the time for Mashiach has arrived. This is, of course, the famous pasuk from Malachi. Hine anochi shaleach lechem es Eliyahu hanavi. I'm sending Eliyahu leheshiv lev avos al banim velev banim al avosam, to return the hearts of the children to their fathers and the fathers to the children. So we already see Yaakov's life. Yaakov is living, because as long as Eliyahu is guaranteed to come and return the hearts of the children to their father, that means Yaakov's children to return, he's the avos, to return to him, to make sure that the end of history, the children, the Jewish nation that exists, are living according to the legacy of Yaakov himself, that his legacy lives on through his children. He is alive through his children, and Eliyahu must ensure this. He's holding on to the vav. Now a vav, we know what a vav is. A vav is a chibor. A vav ha-chibor. It's a connecting. In Hebrew language, vav means and. It connects the previous story to the following story, or the previous idea to the following idea. Vav itself is a hook, a vav. It's a vav ha-chibor. There is going to be a chibor, a connection between the ancestors and the last generation that will come, and they will be returned and they will be reunified, and Eliyahu is responsible for this job. So Yaakov is holding on to the vav of Eliyahu, that he will come and he will ensure that there will be a future. And that will be that, in that case, Yaakov will truly be alive. If anywhere before that point we lose ourselves, we completely disintegrate into the Goyim, we there's no longer a Jewish people, Yaakov is not alive anymore. So Yaakov Lomeis Bedrash means that Eliyahu, who didn't die in Pshat, comes and ensures that Yaakov, who didn't die in the world of Drush, remains alive in that world by ensuring that his children remain connected. I just want to go through the sources in Yirmiyahu, where Yaakov is mentioned, is written Male. One is Perek Lamid, Pasuk Yud Ches. Ko Amar Hashem, so says God, Hinini Shav Shavus Ahale Yaakov. I will return the captivity of the tents of Yaakov. Umishkanos of Arachem, and I will have pity on its dwelling places, on its Mishkanos. V'nivnasat Yiraltila, and the city will be built upon its ruins. V'armon al mishpato yeshev, and the palace will be inhabited once more in its usual manner. This is clearly about the eventual Geula. Then we have Lamed Gimel Chavav, which tells us that even though through Gullus the Jewish people will go through a hard time, and Yaakov's children will not necessarily rule over Klal Yisrael, and the Levium will not necessarily be the spiritual authorities, nevertheless, at the end, in the time of the redemption, everything will be restored. And the pasuk says, "Gam zera Yaakov v'David avdi emas." There will be a period where even the seed of Yaakov, written mole, I will reject, and I will not take mikachas mizaro moshlem al zera Avraham, Yitzchak v'Yaakov, and I will not take from his seed to rule over Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. But this is in context, by the way, of the perek of the geula. By the way, the context here is, and the perek is about Od Yishama Ba'are Yehuda Kol Sason V'Kol Simcha Kol Chasan V'Kol Kala, and that even though the gullus will be long and hard, in the end there will be redemption. And then he says, Ki Ashiv Eshavusam V'Rechamtim, and I will return their captives and I will have pity on them. Mem Vav Pasuk Chav Zayin in Yirmiyahu says, Ba'ata Altira Avdi Yaakov, that's written Chaser, plain. V'Altechas Yisrael, that's the one he quotes from, Rabbi Yitzchak, to prove that Yaakov's still alive. Gihinini Moshiach HaMeirachok V'Zarach HaMeiretz Shivyam V'Shav Yaakov, and Yaakov will return V'Shakar and be at peace V'Shanan V'Ein Machrid, and no one will make him afraid. And Nun Aleph 19:51-19, the pasuk is Lo Ke'elach Chelek Yaakov, not like these. He speaks about the people before him. Not like these is Yaakov's portion. Ki yotzer hakol hu v'shevet nachlaso, for he is to him the creator of the universe. Hashem is to Yaakov the creator. And Yaakov is the tribe of his inheritance. Hashem tzavokos shemo, gods, the host of creation is his name. In other words, with the trust in Hashem, who has sworn, who has promised, Yaakov, the promises to Yaakov will come true. So these places all speak about that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will keep his promises and Yaakov will live again through his children. Notice the word in the Rashi here that Yaakov has taken the Vav of Eliyahu. He's taken it as Eravon. He's taken it as a guarantee, collateral. Now we know that word Eravon. Arvus. Responsibility, one for the next. Eliyahu is responsible for making sure that Klal Yisrael will live and that Yaakov will live. And not just that Yaakov's life in Drush will be expressed through the pshat and the fact that the Jewish people will alive in this world. Eliyahu is responsible for Klal Yisrael. Kol Yisrael arevim zelazeh. Now why is Eliyahu Anavi picked out to bear this burden of arvus, of responsibility for the entire nation of the Jews, not just the nation that exists in the future when Eliyahu comes? Eliyahu is responsible for making sure that all of Jewish history reaches its culmination, that there was a point that for our survival all these thousands of years, there was a point to it. The fact that we went through so much and we survived, to lose it all in the end means there is no point of any of our tzaros that we lived through, if in the end we just self-destruct. The only thing that makes all of history meaningful and purposeful and of any relevance is the fact that in the end we will reach that final stage. Eliyahu is responsible for giving meaning and purpose to all of Jewish history retrospectively by coming in the end. He is responsible for arvus. He's responsible for Klal Yisrael. His midah is arvus. He takes responsibility. Who is Eliyahu Anavi? Let's think about Eliyahu. So in the Medrash, Eliyahu identifies himself as Ben Beno Shel Rachel. He is the great-grandson of Rachel. Now there's machlokas. Some identify Pinchas with Eliyahu, and Pinchas was a Levi. And the reason he's identified with Eliyahu is because Pinchas lived a very, very, very long time, and Eliyahu never dies, and therefore in some way he's alive, whatever that means. And it's strange for Chazal to accept two people living for so long, so they link them together. Also, both were Kanaim, remember? both were zealots. There's a linkage, but Eliyahu himself identifies himself as Ben Beno Shel Rachel. Not Leah, he's from Rachel. Now let's think about the mida of arvus, of responsibility, vis-a-vis Rachel. If you had to identify her primary mida, the greatest act of her life, of remember what we spoke about by Avraham, we said that every one of the challenges of the avos and the imahos, if you had to distill them to their essential, you know, core, what was the challenge we could say about all, every single nisayon, what the malach said to Avraham, lo chasachta es bincha es yechidcha, you did not withhold. You did not hold on to your own needs, your own agenda, your own opinions, what felt, what was right for you, what you needed to survive. You didn't hold on, you surrendered. Avram surrendered, Yitzchak, he surrendered, as we spoke about, all the logic, all the promises Hashem had made him, everything that made sense, his life's work, he surrendered it all. So did Rachel. When Rachel gave Leah to Yaakov, we spoke about this, it is an act of surrender of her future, of her goals, of her aspirations, of her being united with Yaakov. We talked about the idea that she had no assurances that because she did this act of surrender, of giving her sister to her husband, that she would be rewarded. She had no assurances that, oh, because she did this act of Mesiras Nefesh, she would have a long life and many children, remember? And she didn't have either of them. It was an act of arvus. Kol Yisrael arevim ze lazeh. She had no choice because Leah would have fallen into the lot of Esav. She wanted to be connected to Klal Yisrael. She wanted to be the mother of the Shvatim. She wanted to have a future in Nitzchias and what is eternal and what is true. That Rachel had no choice. In her mind, she had no choice. She was overcome by a feeling of arvus, of responsibility for Leah. Now it's clear that the arvus of Rachel exists in her zera and her seed and her children. Yosef's entire role as the monarch of Egypt, as we said, it begins to diminish when Yaakov dies, is in order to sustain and take care of his brothers. He tells them that Psukim in Vayigash are filled with Yosef comforting them, saying, you didn't send me here, and it's not your fault. And God sent me here before you to set up this place for you and prepare for you and to take care of you and to sustain you. His entire leadership was only for responsibility for his family. That's pshat. That's clear in the Psukim. His midah was arvus, responsibility for the rest of his brothers, and therefore he never blamed them. We spoke about the idea that in the beginning, when Yosef realized he was being groomed for Malchus, that he was destined to be a melech, that he had dreams that he'd be a melech, that his father gave him Ksonas Pasim, he understood that he was destined for greatness and for leadership. But it's not necessarily clear that he understood what his role as leader would be. And later on, when the dreams began to play themselves out, remember we quoted the pasuk, he saw his brothers, Vayizkar es chalomosav, Asher Cholam Lohem. My grandfather says there, he remembered at that point the dreams and he realized he dreamed them on their behalf. Those dreams were telling him that he was to sustain them, not to rule over them. He was a king, but a king like a mother who supports and builds up and gives life to. Not a Moshe from the top that overwhelms and controls. He was a leader, but his leadership was designed for this purpose. Now, we know Yosef had the midah of arvus, Rachel had the midah of arvus, Eliyahu is b'nei bonav shel Rachel. His midah is also arvus. He comes to take responsibility for all of Klal Yisrael. Now, the truth is that the children of Leah did learn from Rachel and Rachel's act of self-sacrifice, how also to raise themselves up and take achrayus and responsibility for each other. The whole story with the sale of Yosef came about because they did not have a sense of arvus for Yosef, a sense of responsibility for Yosef. They didn't like what he said, they thought he was a threat, and they didn't sense that they needed to be responsible for him. They did not accept him. They rejected him. However, when it came to bringing Binyamin down to Egypt, and Yaakov was so reluctant to letting Binyamin go, Yehuda, who was the ringleader, who was the one who suggested to sell Yosef, the one who didn't display arvas for his brother, didn't have a sense that Yosef also might have a crucial role to play in the nation of the Jewish people that was being built. He was the one that promises that he will take responsibility for Binyamin. He does tshuva on his lack of arvos for Yosef, and he says to Yaakov, Anochi ervenu, I will take responsibility for him. From my hands you can demand him. I take total responsibility for Binyamin. He's done tshuva. And later in Vayigash, when he's making a speech in front of Yosef, this is when Yosef breaks down. This is when Yosef can no longer contain himself. When Yehuda says to his brother Yosef, he says, the father, if I come back and I do not have this boy with me, v'nafsho kshura b'nafsho, and their souls are intertwined, they are very close together, and he will see that I don't have him, he will die, Yaakov will die, he tells him, and he will go down in anguish to his grave. Ki avdecha, he's talking to Yosef, me, your servant, arav eshanar me'im avi, I have taken responsibility for this youth from my father, saying, if I do not bring him back, I have sinned all my life. Yehuda learns the Midah of Arvas, and he says, Anochi Ervenu, I will take responsibility for him. So even if Eliyahu is from Leah, from Pinchas, whatever it is, the Midah of Arvas has been communicated from Rachel to Bnei Leah. It's very interesting. This Arvas works its way through history. First of all, we have Kalev and Yehoshua, the two spies that stay together, and they do not fall into the plot of the other spies. Kalev is from Yehuda, Yehoshua is from Ephraim. Then you have later on in history, Shaul, who's Mnei Banav Shel Rachel. Okay, he's from Binyamin, and he's threatened by Goliath, and he's helpless. And Yishai says to David, go see how the battle's doing. And he says to David, Es ervosam, I think. What's the word? Tikach. Take. And the Chazal don't know what that means. And the Chazal, the shot is hard. And Chazal say, take the arvus that Yehuda, your great grandfather, David's great grandfather, promised to Binyamin, Shaul's great grandfather. Ves ervosam tikach, I think he says there, take the arvus, the Chazal say, and go now and bail out Shaul. And David went and fought Goliath. Later on, Shaul's son Yonasan and David, it's the same words it says about Binyamin and Yaakov, nafsho kshura b'nafsho, those words are used about Yonasan and David. Okay? This is a pattern through history, that there's an arvus between Yehuda and between Bnei Banav Shel Rachel, between Leah and Rachel. In the end, Eliyahu, who calls himself the great-grandchild of Rachel, takes responsibility for Klal Yisrael. Remember that in the final Geula, Rachel is crying. She's buried in Beis Lechem for this purpose, right? And we say, Mini kolich mibechi, don't cry so much, your children will return. It's Rachel who is always feeling the pain of her children not being there. She takes responsibility for all her children, not just Yosef and Binyamin, all of Klal Yisrael, Leah's children also. Now, Arvos is the exact opposite of Sinas Chinam. The brother sold Yosef. This is considered an act of Sinas Chinam. But the story came full circle, and in the end, Yosef welcomes them back with Arvos and doesn't blame them and doesn't in any way condemn them. Doesn't discuss their hatred that what they did to him. He obliterates it. He causes it to disappear with his arvus. So too the gullus that we're in was started with Sinas Chinam, and we know now it's clear that Eliyahu HaNavi is waiting. He is a guarantor of the geula, but he's been Mnei Banav Shel Rachel, which means he has the mid of arvus. It's his job to bring Klal Yisrael back. But first, Klal Yisrael have to deserve Eliyahu HaNavi. We speak about this all the time. Everybody says the sin of Sinas Chinam is what is holding things back. The question is, and with this idea we'll begin to close, what is Sinas Chinam? If it would be such a simple problem to solve, we would have solved it long ago. Sinas Chinam seems to mean senseless hatred. But everybody who hates somebody has a very good reason. The brothers had a very good reason for hating Yosef. They thought that Yosef was going to undermine them. He was positioning himself to be the sole inheritor of Yaakov's legacy, and they would all be banished like Yishmael and Esau. They didn't realize that by ridding themselves of Yosef, they destroyed the foundation of the Jewish people, because there could be no Am without Yosef. Yosef had the power, remember we spoke about, of extending the koach of Yaakov. Yaakov had the koach of all his children were Jews, unlike Yitzchak and Avraham. But we said that that koach, the fact that the Jews, even if he sins as a Jew, that's Yaakov's koach, that all his children are Jews, is not enough. There has to be the koach that the Jews will not disintegrate, disappear, that they will not assimilate in Golis. That was Yosef, the extension of Yaakov, that he ensured with the Potiphar, Eshes Potiphar issue, that even the Jews, that even though they're born Jews and that they can sin, they can still be Jews, but they will not abdicate completely. Remember the Chazal tell us that Yaakov is like a fire, but Yosef is the spark that extends the power of the fire to burn the Kash, which is Esav. We spoke about the idea that Yosef is the assurance that the Jewish people will survive as he survived. They didn't realize when they were getting rid of him. They thought they were saving the nation, preserving their position as Jews. They didn't realize that without Yosef, there's no nation at all. Remember we spoke about Yosef's stone on the Choshen was the onyx, and on the epaulets of the Kohen Gadol there were two stones with each one at 6 shvatim. The stones were onyx, Yosef's stone. He was the Yesod, the foundation, and Mashiach ben Yosef comes before Mashiach ben David to ensure that there will be a Geula. We've spoken about this also in the past, not for now. The bottom line is Sinas Chinam, senseless hatred. They didn't think it was senseless at the time. Neither did the Jews in the end of the second bias think that their hatred was senseless. The Bar Yonim realized that the Romans, and this Tuesday is Asar B'Tevis, so it's appropriate to speak about this for a minute. What happened with that destruction? How did it come about? So the Jews had enough food in Yerushalayim stored up to sit out a siege that could have taken 3 or more years. So the Bar Yonim didn't, they realized there was no initiative to fight the Romans. And they wanted to fight. They wanted to fight the Romans. They did not want to sit there helpless and hold out, you know, and wait for the siege to be over, wait till God to intervene or whatever. So they burned all the food. We know this story. And the other Jews in Yerushalayim now were starving. So they had to fight. They had to get out of the city. They had to get food. The Romans wouldn't let them out. They'd kill them. You can't break a siege. And then they were forced to fight. And all of Yerushalayim fell because of that. So is that senseless hatred? To hate the Bar Yonim? The Bar Yonim were the zealots, the people that forced the fight. So everyone will say my hatred is not senseless. So what does Sinas Chinam mean? It seems to be that Sinas Chinam means that despite what you think, this hatred will not lead to a productive end. It's destructive hatred. It's not going anywhere good. If with the brothers it didn't go, they were used as shlichim, but the fact that they were getting rid of him did not lead to a strengthening of Klal Yisrael. Only because Hashem came in, they were shlichim, but they could have destroyed all of the Jewish people. What the fight in the end of the second bias didn't strengthen our people. We were destroyed. We went into a gullus for 2,000 years. We might have good reasons that we're angry at a person and we can't make shalom with them. The question is, will it lead to something productive for our future life, or will it be destructive? This is the question. And that already is a very complicated cheshbon, because we have to know and we have to understand the person and their motivations and the community and their motivations. And it becomes much more complex to know where is this fight leading to, good or to bad. And my grandfather says here the following. Not right here, he says it by Korach. We learn from Korach, Kol Machlokes, that's L'shem Shamayim, Asad L'skayim, it has a benefit, it's productive. What is a machlokas that's for the sake of heaven? Hillel and Shammai. What's a machlokas that's not for the sake of heaven, that has no future, that's not destined to produce anything productive? Moshe and Korach. Now everybody asks, what do you mean Moshe and Korach wasn't L'shem Shamayim? Moshe was L'shem Shamayim. He was fighting Korach, who was denying his legitimacy. He was denying the fact that what Moshe taught the Jewish people came from God. He said Moshe was making it up. This is not a machlokas L'shem Shamayim. So my grandfather explains the following. Critical. A machlokas L'shem Shamayim is a case where both parties agree that the other party is L'shem Shamayim. If both believe that the other one is doing what they're doing, L'shem Shamayim, to arrive at MS, then that machlokas is positive and beneficial because they love each other, because they're both trying to get to the root, to the core, to the truth. And Hillel's children married Shammai's children. The institutions, they married each other, and the children married each other. They didn't have any hatred between them, though they're fighting for the Torah. However, because Moshe realized that though he was L'shem Shamayim, Korach was not L'shem Shamayim. So no benefit would come from pursuing this machlokas. He went to Korach's tent, remember this? And he said, please, don't fight. Drop it. I'm begging you. He called Korach. Remember, he tried to make shalom. He tried not to bring this to a head. So when we have a situation of sinas chinam, and we know on the other side we are forced, we must have a sense of arvos kol yisrael marevim zeh lazeh, to see the good and to see the benefit and the contribution of this person. And though it's hard to see this person's contribution and we feel like they are detrimental, the question is, maybe they are detrimental, but that doesn't give us any permission to pursue any type of machlokas with them, because it has no future. It's only destructive. It's not productive. If we're sure that they're not L'shem Shamayim, then we don't pursue the machlokas. That's a strange way to look at it. That's exactly when we drop the fight, when we know they're not L'shem Shamayim. They're not doing this for the right reasons. They're doing it for their own reasons, for their own flaws, their own personality deficits, their own issues. That's why they're going down this road. That's when we drop everything and make shalom. It's exactly counterintuitive to what we would think. In any case, all this is because Kol Yisrael, Arevim Zelzeh, this is the Iker Midah of Rachel, of Eliyahu. And if we ourselves, and it's a challenge, mostly with the ones we're closest to see the benefit, to see their good point, to be responsible, to take care of them, then we hold on to the Midah of Eliyahu, we bring Eliyahu, and we ensure that Yaakov lives in the world of Drush, that Yaakov is alive, and that his spirit is with us, and that we come ultimately to the future Gula.